children. Hi, and welcome to Cartwheels on the Sky, Poets, Poems, and Discovery. I'm your host, Blake Moore, and for the next 30 minutes, you're going to get a glimpse into the poems and process of Willits poet Dan Roberts. Before I share a conversation from earlier this week, I want you to know that Dan Roberts is a poet, artist, and radio producer living in the Redwood Forest of Mendocino County for the last 45 years. He was born in Oakland, California, went to high school in Berkeley, and graduated from UC Davis in 1970 in creative writing and modern European literature. He read poetry in Davis, Sacramento, and Berkeley from the late 1960s on. He produced the Wild Sage Poetry Radio program on KZWX for 10 years, has taught as a California poet in the schools for over 30 years, and has published two chapbooks of poetry, Hunting for the Sun at Night and Heresies. His paintings and photographs have been exhibited around Northern California since the 1970s. He currently produces an internationally syndicated radio program, The Shortwave Report, as well as a music and poetry show, Rhythm Running River, and a national award-winning youth program called Youth Speaks Out, all on KZOX Mendocino. He has raised three children while developing a homestead in the mountains northwest of Willits. Here's our conversation.
So, Dan Roberts, it's really a pleasure to have you here with me on Cartwheels on the Sky.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, great. Why don't you start us off with a poem?
Okay, here's a poem I wrote for the 2013 Mendocino Spring Poetry Celebration. Another Mendocino Spring Poetry Celebration. No solar eclipse. No weddings below deck. No David Durrett. But yes, Richard Cooper. How many readers under 40, under 30, over 70? How many poems will Dan Essman's obnoxious kitchen timer screw up? What ghost will visit us? Fiona Perkins? Lynn Stoller? How many times will our eyes well up? How many times will my diaphragm ripple in laughter? How many times will I think, crap, I wish I'd written that? The word celebrated with more words, new word arrangements, phrases, fresh insights from words like prism, snare, data center. Phrases like prism, snare, data center. Haiku like, ain't just Verizon, prism, snare, data center. Can the sky fall twice? How many poems were written with magnetic words on a refrigerator? How many were borrowed from overheard conversations? How many could only emerge during self-imposed solitary confinement? How many poems will be played on KZYX? How many will appear on a printed page? How many will be recalled in 50 years as symptomatic of a final magnificent attempt to keep a green gold culture thriving while entering the portal of an environmental black hole? And how many poems will inform us tomorrow and the next day? And the day after that.
Yes. How many indeed. Like you say, how many poets over 70? There's quite a few of them now in Mendocino County, aren't there?
Yeah, there's quite a few of us.
You really are part of the legacy of poetry in Mendocino County in the sense of bringing it to light, bringing it to the ears of more people that aren't necessarily only in the poetry world. Can you talk about that a little bit and how you got started with that kind of Herculean and really wonderful philanthropic act?
Okay, well, when KZYX was going to be started, I met Sean Donovan before it went on, and this is like 1987, and I told him I'd like to do a poetry show, and he said, yeah, we should have a poetry show. That'll be good. And then when the station actually got started, he was very hesitant. He thought I would do something crazy on the radio, and he didn't want to have to deal with that. So he got Jim Cohen to do it, but I was the first guest. So I got on and I read my poetry, and he decided that I wasn't as crazy as I looked. And you know, I told him, I said, look, I go into the classrooms. I mean, I must have some self-control, right? And so immediately the next month, I became a co-host and started inviting poets to come and read. And that went on, well, let's see, from 1989 until 2001 or 2002, I did Wild Sage Poetry. Jim Cohen was a co-host for the first 2 or 3 years, and then he quit because he was too busy, so I did it by myself. And then Kate Dougherty started becoming a co-host, and she did that for several years, and then she quit, and I was doing it by myself again. This is like once a week, driving the Philo from Willits. And then eventually I started sharing a show called One Ocean with Lilia Albuquerque on Sunday afternoons, Music World Music, and then that was in 91. And then in 97, I started doing the Shortwave Report. And so I was, you know, really busy doing a lot of radio stuff. And then in 2001, I got a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to do a youth radio program. And that was 25 hours because it was also involved working in the school. And so I dropped Wild Sage Poetry and started incorporating, mixing, segueing poetry into One Ocean, which had become Rhythm Running River, because Lilia wanted a different title for each of our shows. And so that's what I've been doing since then, and recording poetry readings everywhere in the county since the early 90s. So yeah. I have, you know, a whole boatload.
I've seen you at many, many readings throughout the decades that I've been here. And so much of a, I guess, an archive of sound. Do you chronicle them right away? And how do you choose and curate for your shows?
Well, mostly I do the most recent stuff I've recorded, which has been interesting because the last 6 months I haven't recorded anything. And then when Gordon and I started doing the Spring Poetry Revival in 2005, I think it was, when we started doing that, I was recording that and those poems. And so that was a big boatload of poems right there. And plus, at the time, I was still going to all the readings in Ukiah and recording them. And if there was somebody who I thought was important to record, I would go over to the coast and record over there. Devereaux Baker had a reading series for a while. You know, for 6 months or a year, they'd have a monthly featured reader poetry reading, and I'd record those. So, I mean, I do remember, and then, and, you know, as we're dying off, then I go back and do a retrospective, like I just did Peter Wells, and just yes, before that, I did Ruth Weiss. You know, so I have them on hard drives. You know, it's a lot easier than it used to be with tape. Honestly, it's like so much easier. You can type a name in. It isn't like going through boxes of cassettes that don't sound so good anymore.
It's very true. And then finding something on a cassette, there's no markers, and going through and trying to remember and then getting them.
It's so much work. It's crazy.
I did a little radio back when cassettes were still part of it, and, you know, shifting cassette tapes and trying to find the end. Yeah. You've got some really good poems with your lens on culture. You want to share something?
Yes, my lens on culture. Okay, well, here's one. I wrote this because when I first started teaching poetry in the schools in 87, you know, kids would still say sometimes that they were bored. And kids don't say that anymore. Digital devices ended boredom. So I wrote this poem called The Consequences of the Death of Boredom. When the action slows down, we are left to our devices. Smartphone, tablet, laptop, delivering the entire three-ring circus of the million-layer cake that has no weight and fits in the palm of your hand. Youth used to proclaim, I'm bored, as a stage instruction for the adults to step up their game and produce something to fill the apparent emptiness. That void, a black hole of loss, or a white hole of opportunity, has shrunk in the digital age. That void, where Einstein's elevator rose to a theory of relativity, once shunned as the devil's playground, once filled with repetitious prayers to invisible beings to keep the light on in the darkness, to keep the mind from running wild. And now, at a precipice, the tightrope stretched between the fabulous and the dismal, teetering on environmental collapse, for which we need new, wild answers. We keep our minds busy with a kaleidoscope of images of what our friends are eating, news bites tailored to our likes, condensed ideas, all deployed on a screen, a global gateway to the fabulous and dismal, but not new, where the feral synapse faces extinction, as does the gray matter between ears. Heed the silence. Preserve the empty. Praise boredom. Reach out for nothing.
Fantastic. Do you ever get bored, Dan?
No, actually, I mean, I may have when I was a kid. I don't think so. Actually, I was sick a lot when I was a kid. I had a lot of lung problems when I was a kid. And so I was in bed a lot during the winter times. I'd get sick and be in my room. And this is before, well, my family was before television. And so I think I used my imagination a lot. And I don't remember being bored then either. And
right.
So I have so many things I'd like to accomplish. So no, I'm never bored.
Yeah.
But now that I'm older, I'm getting into the rap scene, you know? So I wrote this poem called "At 71, the Old Man Turns to Rap." I've been smoking hope since I was 20. Fire it up, hold it in, let it out slowly. Hope to cope with the slippery slope of excess care and resulting despair. Who's to say what's fair? So I smoke some hope, fire it up, hold it in, let it out slowly. Try to ignore the war on hope. Try to perceive what I believe, that it's all good and the future's so bright. And that right conquers might. And we bypass the perpetual night that seems imminent. So I smoke some hope. Fire it up. Hold it in. Let it out slowly. And try to plan what I can do along with you to keep the lights in our sight and not go out without a shout. But I doubt that smoking hope without action will have any traction against that beast, extinction.
I like it. Your rap poem.
Yeah. It's about time, you know. I have my baseball cap on sideways, you know, and I got a big gold chain around my neck with a clock.
It's about time.
Yeah, so it reminds me that it's time, it's now. That's why I do it.
Yeah, I've worked a little bit early 2000s, mid-2000s, a bit younger. I used to bring rap into the classrooms and have the students write their own raps and play, you know, people like Common and Drake, like some of the more positive rap was going on, you know, the more the hip-hop style. And then I realized that it's not really me. Even though it appealed, I'm kind of more like Mary Oliver. or Lawrence Ferlinghetti, you know. I mean, a kind of a mix between those two, you know, where I just realized that some of those genres don't quite fit my temperament.
No, I totally understand that. And I had the same experience in that I tried to find rap that I could take seriously. And, you know, you mentioned Mary Oliver and Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and I think of T.S. Eliot and William Butler Yeats. And so that's where I'm coming from. So I think that I'm trying to be this voice that's left that can pass on, because a lot of the poetry that I actually perform in the classroom for the students, which is a fair amount of what I do in the classroom, it's definitely not rap poetry. I want them to have the experience of what the human voice can do, and it's like the conciseness of poetry, you know, that you're squeezing it into, it's more profound. And the rhyming thing gets off on its own. It gets carried away. I mean, one of the things I love about 20th century poetry is that rhyming and repeated meter is not a requirement. And I think it's far more significant. I mean, I grew up in the Bay Area, and, you know, so poetry was a big part in the 50s and 60s. I mean, I was born in 48, so, and I had an uncle who was associated with the beat poets. He was the black sheep of the family, of course. So the whole beatnik thing was, everybody knew about it. Everybody knew, had some sense of what people were doing in the Bay Area. And so when I started reading in Berkeley in the late 60s, there was a whole, you know, it was an amazing number of poets that were living in the Bay Area in the late 60s. So here's a poem that I wrote about the fires. And specifically, this was back in 2017, specifically about the Paradise Fire. Because, you know, that was such a crazy time. And our own experience here, we haven't had such a deadly thing where a whole bunch of people have perished and, you know, whole towns being wiped out. So I wrote this poem. It's called Smoke and Mirrors, or Where There Is Smoke, There Are Mirrors. Smoke and mirrors, motives ajar, questions repeating, answers retreating. Navigate through the scar charts, keloid calligraphy, absence of origin, legends of divinity, amoebic consciousness, DNA rearranged as DAN, rhythmic myths, missed drumbeats, nomadic patterns, chasing the axiom of chance, riding the wheel of misfortune down a hollow route into a tunnel left by gold mining. Fingers slip, grip lost, dropping or falling, beginning or ending, growth rings obscured. View from the ridge, obscured by smoke, incomplete combustion, minute particles of ash from a copy of Walden's Pond, burned in a trailer in Paradise, lodging in my lungs, in the cavity next to my heart. Yet through the smoke, a visual echo from a fragment of a mirror that when positioned correctly, I see myself across the gray cloud, intact, unburned, seared by fear, aching for people that I will never meet, tent cities in the Kmart parking lot, listening at 6 for the death toll, thinking, maybe this will go away, realizing maybe they have to go away, scrambling across the state, the country, wondering why the fickle finger of fate chose them. Paradise, lost. Redwood Valley, lost. Tomkai, lost. Santa Rosa, lost. Looking for someone, something to blame. Climate change in a country led by deniers. PG&E, Bankruptcy will protect the shareholders. Karma, get friggin' real. In the smoke, the mirrors tumble. On the street, homeless stumble. Politicians fumble as the safety net crumbles. Where there is smoke, there are mirrors.
Ooh.
That's not too jolly.
That's not too jolly, is that what you said?
You wanted jolly stuff, right?
Yeah, it's perfect. Well, and you also right now are, as you mentioned at the start of our conversation, you've been in a lot of smoke for the last few weeks. You're pretty close to the Oak Fire.
Yeah, I'm a mile and a half away from it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I'm pretty close. And the August Complex fire is 15 miles away. So it's actually, everything has become, it seems, a lot closer now than it used to.
Right.
That's been really, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of beyond words in so many levels. I think we're all looking at this and maxed out on where do we put this in our brains? How do we hold space for all that's going on right now? And I think that's one of the reasons why this poetry show to me is so important, because poets seem to have a different way of, I don't want to call it a silver lining, because I don't think we're quite there right now, but there is something else that we can all relate to that takes place within the container of the pain that we're all facing that I believe poetry can speak to, if that makes sense to you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I was nodding my head.
Okay.
You can't see it.
The radio nod.
It doesn't translate good through the telephone, but he was nodding his head. He knew. He knew what you meant.
Yes,
listen,
exactly.
My latest poetry project has been writing holy cards for Greta, Thunberg, who's a total inspiration to me. And, you know, when I want to feel hopeful, I think of Greta Thunberg and the way she's led young people in around the world now, but
yeah,
originally in Europe, to try and confront the environmental catastrophe we're having. And what a holy card is, if you're not Catholic, there were these small cards. I was raised Catholic, became quite an agnostic by the time I was 12. But anyway, these holy cards were little pictures of saints, and you could collect them, kind of like baseball cards, but, you know, much more spiritual. And they'd have little stories about, you know, how they suffered horrible deaths, basically, on the back. Anyway, so I wanted to do these images with words for Greta Thunberg on the 50th anniversary of the Whole Earth Festival, which I was involved in Davis, where the first one happened in 1969, actually, and then 1970 it was called the Whole Earth Festival, with Jose Arguelles, who did the Mandela book and a whole bunch of other stuff as time went on. Anyway, so there was going to be this poetry reading on the 50th anniversary of the Whole Earth Festival, and I was invited to read. And so I wrote three poems. I'm writing. I've got two of them done. Good thing it didn't happen on time, I guess. So I'd like to read at least one of those.
Perfect.
And so the first one is called Earthrise Photo, December 1968. And this is, you know, when that image came out of the Earth from the moon, it really changed our perspective of how we really look at where we are. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it's kind of like we were flat earthers before, and then we looked back and went, well, actually, we really are spinning around in space. So this is printed on a large image of that. This poem is printed on a large image of the Earth from space. Earthrise photo. Whole Earth photo from the moon. One Earth. A sphere in vast emptiness. One land, indivisible, without borders. One ocean, blue marble womb. One atmosphere, thin as a breath on a Christmas tree ornament. Despite the ridiculous expense to drive to the moon, to conquer the unconquerable again, some images turn icon. have restorative powers are a gateway for a crusade, like a crucifix in the medieval war, like manifest destiny to please pretend beings, to justify torturing and slaughtering the indigenous everywhere for bowing to the earth, for being inseparable fauna, for not worshiping the conqueror's hallucination. Earthrise, ecology, our new crusade to teach the limitations, the fragility, the consequences, the tragedy of a species making innumerable other species extinct in the name of accumulated wealth, in the name of imaginary superheroes said to dwell in the sky, even farther than the moon, I guess. This photo from the moon, intended to disregard American poverty, distract viewers from Vietnam, Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Kennedy, anti-war and race riots. This photo, an arrow aimed to mitigate the disasters slithering into the White House. This photo, transformed into a coat of arms for multitudes venturing into Elysian fields where the interconnectedness of all is seen, tasted, heard. This photo shifted the paradigm before we knew what a paradigm was. This photo, Earthrise 1968, Holy Card for Greta, number one.
That's fantastic. Fantastic. Could you send me that picture and I'll include that on the link for the show?
Sure.
Well, wonderful. Well, we are 100% out of time, so it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Dan Roberts.
Well, thanks for all you do.
And do you have a website that we can give?
Yes, outfarpress.com. That's like far out, but backwards, you know? It's like, obviously. Some people have a hard time remembering it, but just think far out backwards.
Well, thank you.
The other website is youthspeaksout.net, which I've been doing Youth Speaks Out for 20 years, and there's a bunch of amazing shows up there that you can stream or download, from just high school kids talking about, like the ones that are trying to go to college now, most recent show, back to talking to John Trudell, to Michael Franti, to a bunch of political leaders in Mendocino County over the last 20 years, from high school students interviewing them. So that's youthspeaksout.net.
Fabulous. You are fabulous. Thank you, Dan Roberts.
Well, thank you so much, Blake. It's an honor to be on your show.
And that concludes my interview with Willits poet Dan Roberts. I'll be back next week with Ukiah poet Dan Barth. Stay tuned for more great programming right here on KGUA. Thank you so much for listening. And remember to keep your hearts open no matter what. That is what's going to keep us together. Have a fabulous evening. Oh, yeah.